Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thanks to famed children's singer Uncle Moishe, the importance of loving Jews was seared into my mind from a very young age. In one of his most well-known songs, he sings, "Don't walk in front of me, I may not follow. Don't walk behind me, I may not lead." I know you want me to sing this now, but bear with me. "Just walk beside me and be my friend, and together we will walk in the way of Hashem. Via hafta l'reicha kamocha, ze klal gadol Torah," the last line being a verse in this week's Parsha, of loving each Jew like yourself. This is a great principle of the Torah. I was pretty heartbroken when I discovered that the opening lyrics are actually attributed to Albert Camus, the famed existentialist philosopher, but I've since made my peace with Uncle Moishe's light plagiarism. Good thing he was never Professor Moishe. We'd be hearing a lot more about that on social media. However, the song's concluding lines are also not Uncle Moishe's. They belong, of course, to Rebbe Akiva, who cites the words of our pasuk, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, in our Parsha, Perek Yud Tes 19, and the 19th verse, 19 squared, look at that. And then Rebbe Akiva adds, "Ze klal gadol batorah." This is a very important principle in the Torah. Rashi as well cites this on the spot. Rebbe Akiva's statement, he quotes it from the Medrash in the Sifra. It's also could be found in the Yerushalmi Nedarim, the Talmud Yerushalmi Nedarim. And I don't know why, but I suppose I always gave Uncle Moishe a harder time than Rebbe Akiva. When I discovered Uncle Moishe's opening verses were attributed to Albert Camus, I shared my outrage in my high school yearbook, and I actually have this in the Substack, a picture from my high school yearbook where, you know, part of the shtick and the humor column, we had in big letters like a news report, "Uncle Moishe violates United States intellectual property law." And I had a whole tumult. I can't believe this isn't Uncle Moishe's lines. But what of Rebbe Akiva? What exactly is he adding to this line of the Torah? We have an explicit verse, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, and Rabbi Akiva just seems to be adding Zeklal Gadlava. This is a great principle. This is a great one. I feel like we let him off easy. Why exactly is loving your fellow Jew a great principle of the Torah? Treating others nicely or kindly is hardly unique to the Torah or to Jewish thought. So what exactly is Rebbe Akiva adding? And why is this principle so central to Torah? To understand this, let's explore a darker chapter in Israel's political history, the murder of Chaim Arlaseroff. I'm going to butcher his last name this entire time. I apologize in advance. And in particular, Rav Kook's response. On a summer Friday night in June in 1933, while strolling with his wife on the beaches of Tel Aviv, Chaim Arlaseroff was shot dead. His wife later stated during the trial that two men had approached them, shot her husband, and then disappeared. His murder embroiled the entire Zionist movement for decades to come. After 2,000 years of ghost-like wandering about the face of the earth, Arlaseroff was quoted as saying in the New York Times article published right after his murder, "Our people have finally found their home again." Chaim Arlaseroff was not just any Israeli. Just 34 years old, he had worked in the labor Zionist movement, left of center, and was a leader of the Jewish Agency. On the Wednesday before he was murdered, on June 14th, 1933, he had just returned from Germany, where he had attempted to broker a deal, later known as the Havara Agreement, with the rising Nazi government so German Jews would be able to resettle in the land of Israel. This was obviously not an insignificant piece of information when he was murdered that Friday night on June 16th. This became Israel's version of the JFK assassination. Conspiracies proliferated, all trying to make sense of the death of this emerging Zionist leader. Arlaseroff was the key member trying to figure out the trajectory that the Jewish people should take vis-a-vis the state of Israel. He was presciently concerned that as the Nazi power rose to more and more power, the world would be cast into a world war. This is 1933. And Britain, he was concerned, would no longer have the ability or interest to govern the land land of Israel. The warring political factions in Israel at the time had different visions of what the next step should be. A partitioned state? Should Israel invest in urban development or rural development? Should peace be sought with their Arab neighbors? It was a delicate time in Israel's history, and Arlaseroff's murder brought all these issues to the fore. Without the assailants in hand, the investigation immediately turned to members of the Zionist Revisionists, the party of Zev Jabotinsky, who adamantly boycotted any sort of negotiations or deals with the anti-Semitic Nazi government. Attention soon turned to three members of the Zionist Revisionists, Avraham Stavsky, Tzvi Rosenblatt, and Abba Achi Meyer. The motive was there. They were the opponents to making any deal with Germany. Chaim Arlaseroff had just returned that Wednesday from Germany. And to help bolster the case, Mrs. Arlaseroff actually picked Stavsky and Rosenblatt out of a questionable police lineup. Achi Meyer was only accused of hatching the plan, but they were in the lineup and she pointed them out. There were later on, they began to question how accurate this lineup actually was. Jabotinsky, who was not allowed back into Palestine at the time, was outraged that members of his movement were being accused of murder. The vast majority of our people are embittered by the pogrom and blood libel, Jabotinsky said, being waged by Jews against Jews. No one had orchestrated Arlaseroff's murder, he contended. To say otherwise, in his view, was nothing less than a blood libel. Still, the accusations took a major toll on Jabotinsky's revisionist Zionist movement. For the next four decades, in fact, revisionist Zionists would struggle to elect delegates to the Zionist Congress. Other, even more insidious conspiracies emerged. As a boy, Chaim Arlaseroff was very friendly with a girl named Magda Richel. Magda's mother was no longer together with her father. She remarried a wealthy Jewish businessman named Richard Friedlander, who in fact adopted Magda. Later, Magda married, this is shocking, none other than Joseph Goebbels, Nazi Germany's propaganda minister and one of the most virulent, I don't know how to pronounce that, anti-Semites within the movement. Joseph and Magda later committed suicide in Hitler's bunker. It was a day after Hitler committed suicide, and gave their six children cyanide pills. Sociopathic people. In January of 1934, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported on the Goebbels-Arlaseroff connection. Could this early connection to one of the most insidious anti-Semites ever to live somehow explain Chaim Arlaseroff's murder? Britain's justice system was still focused on Stavsky, Rosenblatt, and Achi Meyer. An Arab man named Abdul Majid confessed to the murders but quickly recounted. The focus remained on the revisionist Zionists. All this while, the chief rabbi, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cook HaKohen, remained on the sidelines. Rav Cook didn't want to get drawn into a heated political debate. Instead, he wanted the justice system to complete their investigation. In general, Rav Cook tried to articulate a Judaism that could reach those regardless of their political leanings, but the climate among Jews in Israel was making that harder and harder. He was being forced to choose a side. As Professor Schneer Lyman records in his fascinating article, Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Cook, Letter on Avat Yisroel, which covers most of the general details of the Arlaseroff affair, Rav Cook had met Arlaseroff that year before Rosh Hashanah and even knew his grandfather. Rav Cook initially wanted to silently wait until the investigation was completed. He was willing to have his name attached for an appeal for the defense fund of the accused, but stopped short at declaring their innocence or guilt. Rav Cook's silence was not well received. Abba Achi Meyer sent Rav Cook a nasty letter accusing him of remaining silent during a blood libel. This is the translation from Professor Lyman. If not for the fact that I am aware that you are a Gadol B'Torah, Achi Meyer wrote to Rav Cook, or even more precisely, that you are the Gadol Hadar, the leader of the generation, I would not bother to write to you. It is now 8 months that three Jews are the victims of a false accusation of murder. We are the Dreyfus and Bayless of our generation, but we are not in Paris or in Kiev. We are in Tel Aviv. Why are you silent? You, the leader of Israel, how will you look us in the face after we are acquitted? In the Bayless case, Rabbi Jacob Maza, chief rabbi of Moscow, spoke out openly in defense of Bayless. Maza was not silent. Will you, Rav Cook, remain silent? Achi Meyer and Rosenblatt were eventually acquitted. Stavsky, however, was found guilty and sentenced to death for the murder of Chaim Arlaseroff. Rav Cook could no longer stay silent. Rav Kook issued a proclamation that stated, "I can attest on the basis of my inner conscience that Avraham Stavsky is innocent of the murder charge." Rav Kook sent letters urging other religious leaders to help Stavsky, including to the leading Reform rabbi, Stephen Wise, as well as to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Stavsky, who was not an observant Jew, was deeply moved by Rav Kook's efforts. He wrote Rav Kook a letter thanking him. "I'm a plain Jew and I wonder, why have I merited it that Rav Kook concerns himself so much with my fate? I ask only, Rav Kook, that you continue to remember me in your prayers. My suffering is made easier by the knowledge that none other than you, Rav Kook, looks after me and remembers me when praying to the Lord. May the Lord protect his people." Jabotinsky was elated that Rav Kook finally entered the fray. "The Jewish nation and its youth will never forget the voice you raise, which revealed anew the strength of Jewish tradition," he wrote to Rav Kook. The opponents of revisionist Zionists on the left were outraged by Rav Kook's involvement. Rav Kook's life mission to unite all segments of the Jewish people to rebuild the land of Israel was quickly unraveling in the political storm brewing from Aserlof's murder. Still, Rav Kook remained steadfast in his conviction of Stavsky's innocence, despite the fractious response it was receiving. As Rav Kook saw his position just widen the political turmoil unfolding in Israel, he published a letter clarifying his views. Here's the original, followed by a translation from Professor Lyman. And I'll just read a part of it in Hebrew because it is so beautiful. "Me makor levavi hakoev al shivrei bat ami oshiv lechvodo al mechtavo hayakar she'ani meir alai shamayim va'aretz shechivasti hi gedola mamish b'chol levavi u'b'chol nafshi l'chlal amenu u'lufratehem u'l'chol miflagosehem mipnei she'ani ma'amin be'emuna shalema she'kol chelak mehem hu ever miyuchad b'shir hakoma hakadusha v'hanifla she'hi kineses Yisrael kula b'molei muvna. From the depths of my heart, pained by the tribulations of my people, I respond to your letter. I adduce heaven and earth as witness to my unqualified love with all my heart and all my soul of the Jewish nation as a whole and of every Jew, regardless of his political affiliation. For I believe with a perfect faith that every Jew is a unique limb, a part of that sacred and awesome body known as Knesset Yisrael, the community of Israel in its fullest sense. Every act and every deed, whether mundane or spiritual, with either directly or indirectly, prepares the way for the ingathering of the exiles and the return of Jewish youth to our land is as dear to me as my own soul. I believe and am certain that even by means of these warring political factions, a permanent structure will be built, leading to the full redemption of the Jewish people by the Redeemer of Yisrael. The truth alone in all of its purity informs me and leads me to devote my energies to the rescue of the one consigned to death row. There are no grounds whatever for finding him guilty. I am absolutely certain on the basis of my inner conscience that the accused is innocent of the murder charge." Just parenthetically, Professor Lyman in this classic article, which you should absolutely look up and is of course linked to in our email, speculates what exactly is this inner conscience. There were those who said that it was almost like Ruach HaKodesh, divine spirit, but he seems more convinced that he actually had some informant and evidence that was brought before him that made him change his mind, because initially he was not that convinced and something must have changed and it must be some new information that was given to Rav Kook. The letter concludes by saying, "In every political party and in every movement, there are matters I disagree with. This in no way impairs my boundless and flaming love for our holy nation and its various parts. I love all Jews equally, regardless of whether they revere or despise me. I love them all with a boundless love. Such is my heart's response, dear friend, which I transmit to you respectfully and in love of truth." Rav Kook emphatically explains that his love for the Jewish people extends beyond any specific political ideology or affiliation. His concern was and remains the health of the larger collective entity, Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people. Every Jew, even a plain Jew, even those he disagreed with, had a role to play in building a Jewish future. It is worth noting that after appeal, Stavsky was found innocent. The rest of his life was dedicated to bringing Jews to Israel. In order to help the efforts of the Irgun, Stavsky Lasky purchased a boat to transport arms to fighters in Israel. He decided to call the boat Altalena, after one of the pen names of Zev Jabotinsky. When the boat reached the shores of Tel Aviv, tragically, Stavsky was killed from the gunfire and explosions from the Haganah forces and the famous Altalena incident. He died on June of 1948, 15 years to the month, just a few yards away from where Aserlof was killed on those very same beaches in Tel Aviv in June of 1933. Which brings us back to Rabbi Akiva's statement that loving every Jew is a major principle of the Torah. What exactly is Rabbi Akiva adding to an explicit verse we already know? Aren't all commandments in the Torah important? Rabbi Akiva is doing more than highlighting a powerful pasuk. He is drawing an equivalence between Torah and the love of the Jewish people. And this teaches us something about our obligations and relationships with both. When it comes to Torah, we don't just love the ideas, verses, and passages that make sense to us. A Beit Medrash is loud because people are arguing over the correct interpretation, resolving contradictions, and addressing inconsistencies. There is a commitment to amelus b'Torah, toiling and sweating, to finding meaning within the Torah. But how hard do we work to find meaning and purpose within other Jews, within ourselves? Rabbi Akiva is reminding us that the principles of Torah study need not end on the page, but should extend to our relationships with others and ourselves. We need amelus b'Yisroel, toiling and sweating to find meaning and purpose within and for each and every Jew, of course ourselves included, the Kamocha Jews. It is easy to love Jews in the abstract. It is really challenging to see a Jew before you who grates on you, who you disagree with, and still find Jewish meaning and purpose within their lives. Rav Menashe Klein once remarked about himself, and if you know anything about Rav Menashe Klein, or the Rav of Ungvar, who was a Hasidic Rav, very zealous, but he has one letter that I've always found incredibly moving, where he writes as follows, "Ube'ezras Hashem Yisbarach, Harbe, harbe, harbe kochos, hishkati b'mida zu, ad shehashem yisbarach nosan li ktsas matana, le'ehov, es kol ishme Yisrael, ulehispalal al nidche Yisrael, sheyashuvu be'emes ubelev shalem." With the help of God, I have exerted many, many, many. He says the word harbe three times. Harbe, harbe, harbe kochos. Many, many, many of my own strength for this characteristic of loving each Jew, until God granted me a small gift to in fact be able to love each Jew and pray on behalf of all those distant from their Judaism, that they should find a way to authentically return with a full heart. And this was the message of Rav Kook. We don't just love Jews because our politics align. In truth, as Rav Kook wrote in that letter, no political movement fully aligned with his views. Instead, his commitment was to the Jewish people, which sometimes came at a very serious political cost. When you try to love everybody, everybody ends up hating you. However steep the cost, I think it was worth it. Because loving the Jewish people is like the love of the Torah itself. Even when we can't find the meaning right away, we can still toil, sweat, interpret, and discover the immutable connection of the Jewish people. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.